Selamat datang kembali semuanya. Welcome back to the Indotechno Podcast, Season 3, Episode 25. I'm Alan Hallowell, venture partner at leading early stage Indonesian VC, AC Ventures, and founder of startup consultancy Gizmo Advisors. Now, payments provides the very lifeblood of any fintech ecosystem. It is, for instance, the nucleus of highly diversified fintech juggernauts, such as Ant Financial in China, and is at the core of nearly all of the industry's largest private companies, from Stripe to Revolut to countless others. McKinsey estimates that 90% of merchants are still offline in a country like Indonesia. Meanwhile, the most recent Google Temasek Bain annual Southeast Asia economy report estimates that 95% of digital merchants expect to maintain or increase usage of digital payments in the next 2 years in Indonesia. The secular growth opportunity in this space is undeniable. I therefore clearly have a lot of answering to do around why the Indotechno podcast, after some 2.5 years of weekly episodes, only now is featuring one of Indonesia's leading payments platforms. We are extremely pleased to have join us today Vincent Niswara, CEO of leading Indonesian payments platform Dana. Great to have you with us today, Vince.
Thank you, Alan. Very nice to meet with you as well.
Very happy to be here.
Fantastic. Now, Vince, I've had the chance to pore over a lot of your past interviews during my ongoing quarantine here in Taiwan. There's a very interesting personal history to your current work in Indonesian payments and fintech. Can we start with that?
Sure.
I've been very passionate about payments for a long while. In fact, I'm one of the few entrepreneurs that started in this fintech business back in 2008. So that was quite a while ago. And it fascinated me that at the time, 2008, everybody is going for a lot of the tech innovations in mobile, in social media, in content. But like you said, one of the core, most important parts of the economy, which is payment itself, is not being focused as much. So at the time, I realized that paying for a lot of things is difficult. So I started a company called Indomark back in 2008, and it solves payment problems for people who love to play games. And that was a massive industry at the time. I seen that as an opportunity to enter the market.
Wow, 2008, that definitely qualifies you as an OG or original gangster in the payment space. Now, particularly for our foreign listeners, can you share with us the origin story of Dana itself?
Sure. So continuing a bit about my story of why I started a payment in gaming, I run that business for about 7 years. It turned out to be one of the earliest startups that achieved pretty good scale. At one point of time, we have about 2 million users and we were profitable. So surprise, one of the first fintech company that was actually profitable. And that was amazing. And we had a market leader position, but I realized that I want to do something more. I realized that I wanted to expand this kind of solution, not just for the gamers, but for the wider audience. And for me, that is really important because my passion always been to solve like society pain points. And online payments is definitely one of the biggest pain points at the time. I started to try to expand the company into different segments, but because of our own success at the time, we were stuck in the gaming industry. So it's very difficult for us to get out of that box, out of that perception that you are a game payment company. Why are you offering payment for other things? So we were a victim of our own success. So we've been associated so much to that segment that people find it difficult to think otherwise. So then I decided to look for another opportunity. It's like the same opportunity, but trying to do more. So rather than fighting against the perceptions, I decided that maybe it's a good time for me to restart again. So that was when in 2017, I finally started Dana.
Fantastic. So clearly your first go-to use case for payments years ago was gaming. Let's bring it up to 2022. Tell me about what unique positioning Dana boasts within Indonesia's now pretty crowded payments market.
Very excited to talk about that. We actually just had a town hall to actually reiterate the vision of Dana to our team, to our key team members. And it's interesting, but we have never changed our mission or vision and strategy from day one. So Dana, in a sense, is basically a digital wallet that we want to replace your physical wallet. And that hasn't changed. And then interestingly, though, we are essentially the only one in the market that are trying to do that, because there are so many types of payments. There's a payment gateway, there are e-money players, and then there is what we call it embedded wallet inside third-party apps. And there is a various methods of achieving it. We are the only one in the market that try to be a standalone digital wallet that is open ecosystem, meaning that we, from day one, set out to do a platform model where everyone, whether they're users, whether they're merchants, whether they're financial institutions, that can integrate to our platform and really serve all these broader three constituents together. And we haven't changed from day one. And we've seen that some of the other players, instead of trying to be a platform, they want to be more like a single party payment solution for a big use case. Or they want to be financial service providers, but they do it themselves as a first party model, where we always want to be a three party model. I find it fascinating that we can be in that position, that not only we're pretty unique in the market, but our uniqueness is actually able to help us to be very successful in growing the users, in retaining the users. And at the same time, we are right now one of the fastest growing companies in the market. And a lot of the new users are entirely organic.
I would have to say, from an outsider's point of view, Dana has boasted probably the most consistent positioning in the market. So that all makes sense. Now, Vince, you've spoken at length about financial inclusion. In your mind, what is the single biggest obstacle to financial inclusion in Indonesia reaching the levels that you have in mind?
There are a few things. I think in terms of, I would say, adoption, I think Indonesia is one of the fastest adoptions of digitalizations, I would say probably in the whole world, because we were talking about it at the G20 with some of the central banks and finance ministers from other countries. But at the same time, I think the biggest hurdle is culture and education, because people tend to still want to kind of touch something. They still do not have this 100% trust in everything digital. To be honest, that doesn't make any sense. I think it's just irrational legacy behavior that people tend to trust something if they can see it. Whereas digital, in fact, it can be proven with any data points. It's a safer, cheaper, faster, more hygienic, and better in too many forms. There's a lot of things that is actually beneficial. But this trust, it still needs to grow even more over time. And I believe it's just a matter of time. It's not about whether or not people are going to change or not, because we've seen it in the markets in terms of acceptance. When you talk about the merchants, about 90% of the merchants in Indonesia is still offline. That is changing already. In fact, if you talk about QR payments, out of 65 million SMEs in Indonesia, right now, probably already over 20 million of the merchants is already accepting this QR payments, which is digital payments. So the majority, if you go to large tier one or tier two cities, if you go to any merchants right now and you ask, can I pay using QR? They're already accepting it. But now it's just a matter of the people getting used to it. We've seen that in some of the numbers in the market. In terms of the adoptions, in 2021, about 57% of the working population have at least tried digital payment at least once. 57%. But the frequency is not there yet. So it's just a matter of getting them to get used to it.
Understood. So if adoption and habituation to payments is the bottleneck, that sounds like a pretty easy barrier to break over time. Now, I've spent periods of time at convenience stores and cafes in Jakarta, deliberating amongst a number of 20 to 30% cashback deals. in choosing which e-wallet to use to make my purchase. This was pre-COVID, mind you. Where would you say competition is right now in the O2O payment space?
I think back then, pre-pandemic or even during the pandemic, I mean, a lot of players are very aggressively making sure that more and more users are converting. I think that's the issue of this changing culture and behavior, because if you want to do it fast, you probably need to let them have a very attractive offer. Whereas, as we were talking about, I think it's just a matter of time they're converting. But sometimes I think if there's an opportunity, someone will try hard enough to make sure that the acceleration is there. However, from our point of view, we decided back in the early days of pandemic that incentive is no longer the only way to grow. And we were fortunate that we early on, so basically 2 years ago, we already decided that our unit economics need to be healthy. Everybody is doing it right now because of the global situations, because of the difficulty of the funding in the market. But we already started 2 years ago. So when you talk about competitions, we're still seeing some of the players are still being aggressive, but not necessarily as much as pre-pandemic. Although saying that, we always believe that we are still at the very early stage of this change, because as I mentioned here, 57% of people have done digital payment at least once. But if you take a look at the total retail payments in Indonesia, only about 10% of the retail payment is done by digital payments. So there's still room to grow from 10% to 57%, meaning that if we want to make sure that people are changing to this rail faster, as what had happened in certain markets, as in China, for example, where more than probably 50% of the population has already used this digital payment on a day-to-day basis. If you want to see this happening, I still see that everyone in the market play its role to actually help convert the users. So I honestly don't see competition is at the irrational level. I still see everybody's trying their best to do their own way. Ourselves, we've always believed that our value proposition is about the product and the technology. So that's what we have been focusing on the last 2 years. The others are making sure that they can integrate better with certain ecosystems. And that's totally fine as well. So far, I've seen that all of us are still growing. And so that's an indication of the market is still very early.
Now, you just mentioned China as a means of comparison. And many would indeed compare Indonesia's payment space to that in China. Can you tell us in a nutshell how we are similar and different at this point with China?
I think the similarity is the smartphone adoption. I think that's the most important. The smartphone adoption in China as compared to Indonesia are pretty similar. Indonesia right now, I think it's about 72% of the population already have smartphones. And I think that's a very healthy adoption. The numbers that we've seen is it's going to grow again into about 80-something percent in the next 4 years. And that is, in a sense, or the opportunity of this digital payment or financial inclusion. Because anyone that owns a smartphone can immediately be accessible. Because as long as they can register their phone numbers and they have a login and password, or for some who wants to have a higher value of transactions, and they can KYC themselves, which right now can be fully done digitally. So everyone have access to it. And our government have been very supportive. Our regulators have been very supportive in making sure that these adoptions can be done even faster. I think that's what we've seen the similarity. The difference is, I think in China, it's a pretty close walled garden society where there is not many external or international multinational companies that can enter the market as compared to Indonesia, where it's very much wide open. You have all the biggest giants in the whole world that actually have presence here. You have multiple companies who already got multiple investments from the biggest investors in around the world and actually operating in Indonesia and in the regions. And we have some very successful companies in Indonesia. And I'm so proud of that. And it's just so exciting that Indonesia finally at the forefront of the technology race in the region. So because of that, it's not as simple as one-to-one comparisons, because everything that you do in China, it still has to be domestically targeted, domestically grown, and somewhat protected so that your competition is pretty much in-house, inbound. and where Indonesia, you have so many players into the market. So there is not a single dominant presence here or very few dominant parties here. For us, the strategy has always been trying to focus to deliver the best offering, which for us is payments and financial services, and just work with everyone else for that. And that's why the concept of open platform.
Now, Vince, peeling back the onion a little more in our comparison with China, if I understand Ant Financial's evolution correctly, the group, at least for some period of time, leveraged the Zhifu Bao or Alipay service as a loss leader with the greater purpose of on-ramping merchants and consumers to other profitable Ant Financial products. Is the modus operandi or the MO in Indonesian payments similar?
I think if we take a look into their financials, their payment businesses are generating quite a hefty sum of revenue and gross. So I'm pretty sure, I don't think they see it as a loss leader, similar to us. We do believe that payment is how we grow the user base because that is the number one use case for everyone in the market, aside from social media
content
and search. I think payment is one of the most single biggest use case in any market in the world. That's why a great payment service would enable companies such as ours to have very high adoption among the population. Payment is also very important because through understanding payment behaviors, through knowing what people want to pay, how they prefer to pay, then we can be able to also serve them better financial services. So that's the kind of step-by-step process, creating a good payment platform to understand people's behavior and now offering them financial services that match what they need. So I think that's a workable model already. And we've seen it happens successfully, not only in China, but a few other places around the world. And we are adopting the same kind of model. I think there is really nothing to reinvent because the model already works. But right now, it's a matter of how to execute properly, because that is very important. It's not as simple as everyone can just follow the same model and execute in exactly the same way. Every country has different regulations. Every country has a different kind of infrastructure, a different behavior. So a lot of those things, we need to make sure that we can build for the right segments, for the right people, for the right regulations to make sure it can become executable and successful. But the model works.
Got it. Now that I think about it, I suspect this period of loss-making at Alipay, which probably stretched from 2005 to 2015, was more of a limited interlude designed more to broaden usage and introduce users and merchants to newer services at the time.
I just want to also reply about that. There's a period of time that is not profitable for Ant in China or for any kind of like fintech companies that has a period of time that is a very difficult to be profitable. I think it's just a matter of scale. I truly believe it's a matter of scale. Once you reach a certain scale, you have the economy of scale for you to be not losing money. And I think that's the same with us as well. So for us, we have a path of profitability, even just on the payment itself. And the most important part is just understanding the unit economics.
Let's go back to Indo. Is the industry structurally profitable at this point, or do you see it becoming so next year?
Indonesia is actually one of the most competitive payment fee levels in Southeast Asia or the rest of the world. There's few other countries that adopt such low fee levels. We're still seeing that there is an economy of scale that we can achieve in order for us to be positive, not only just gross margin positive, but a net positive as well. The most important is to make sure that we can build everything, the technology, the operations, the marketing, and all of those costs associated with, for example, the funding costs, the service costs, and everything can actually be sustained or can actually be scaled in a way that eventually we will find that equilibrium of profit. And for us, that's the conscious things that we've been trying to do since year one. And then we've seen it's actually going to happen in the next few years. everything on top of that, all the monetization strategy on top of that now becomes an acceleration of this path to profitability. So that's why I said the model actually works, because the model with the right infrastructures, with the right services, you can actually reach that profitability in certain scale. And that's what we're trying to achieve. How to achieve that scale faster.
The economy scale argument makes eminent sense. Let's talk about company valuation scale. Congratulations on Dana's recent ascent into the ranks of Indonesia's unicorns. I guess Sinar Mas Group and Lazada reportedly led our most recent round, and the media estimates that our valuation has reached $1.2 billion with that last round. We, in fact, have multiple strategic investors in our cap table. How does that impact how we set our strategy, how we prioritize our partners and use cases, and operate day to day?
Well, thank you, Alan. We don't really comment on our valuations because that's always been our philosophy. We don't talk about ourselves too much. However, we've been very grateful for having two new investors, very reputable investors, entering into our cap table. And this is a very important milestone for us as well, because we haven't really had anyone new into our cap table since the beginning of our company setup. And having these two entering us is just an indication that we are starting to open ourselves more and more. And I think that's also a key for us for the future kind of investment strategies and actually a path for us going for IPO. For us, it's very important. We also set our expectation very clear to our investors, even to our newer investors, that we've been very successful in delivering our business projections, in delivering our vision, delivering our strategy, and they bought into everything that we do. So all of these new investors will still want Dana to remain an open platform, to remain as independent as we were, because they trust us as the management, as the people that deliver the scale that we achieved so far. So what we've seen is what we really can do with these reputable investors in our new cap table, right, is that they have a lot of use cases that we can work with. And they're very happy to do that as well, because they've seen how good our technology is. They've actually seen really a lot of the metrics that we always put as our KPIs are the metrics that we concentrate on improving is actually a metric that helps not only their business, but helps the acceleration of everyone's business into the digital ecosystem. We're very excited. We're very excited. There's a lot of opportunities that we can work with them. But at the same time, it's very important. We are still an open platform. We can still work with anyone else as well. In terms of prioritizations, we always put whoever delivers the biggest values to our customer base, let's put that into our prioritization.
Great. So you mentioned that we occupy the open platform part of the market in addressing the different types of payments players around us. Some other players in the Indonesian payment space might be what we call captive solutions, serving largely, if not exclusively, a specific e-commerce platform or ride-sharing or delivery business. This, once again, stands in contrast to our open platform approach. What are the puts and takes of each of these two main approaches?
Well, I can say that the open platform model is really hard to begin with. For us, we didn't have a captive market to start. It was really tough when we started. And the fact that we were also the latest one in the market gave us a very challenging, but at the same time, a bigger opportunity, because then the market is at least being educated enough. Users will find it. I can start paying using my mobile phone. At least that concept exists. But trying to get them to adopt our platform has been the most challenging part since the beginning. Any captive platform, they immediately can leverage their own massive use case, like the e-commerce, the ride-hailing, the deliveries, or some of them are captive physical stores that can offer to have the first earlier adopters to use them. The thing about the captive market, it's a faster to adopt, but there is a certain limit that they can have. Once you reach the limit of your own captive markets, then it's going to get harder to grow. Whereas in our case, it's very hard to adopt at the beginning, But once we achieve a scale, everything is just organically growing so much easier. So I think that's a pro and con. At the end of the day, we're happy we survived through that period of time. And now we've been very successfully growing day by day. We're still achieving record-breaking numbers every day, and the majority of them organically.
Fantastic. So would you say it's easy for an e-commerce platform and a payment solution platform to jointly share or co-own data on a customer transaction? And how do we think about who actually owns that customer in that transaction?
For us, it's very important that we have a strict or zero data sharing policy. So everything that we do really have to be set by user consent. And we make it very clear. We even specify what kind of data, who's going to get this data, and whether or not you're going to accept it on the front. And then we don't put it in a very long term sheet that users will find it difficult to go through, but we make it very simple and straightforward and telling them it's like, hey, this is the kind of the service that you're accepting. This is the kind of data that they need, whether or not you're comfortable to sharing with them. If you're not, we're not going to share it with them. For us, data sharing policy has been very strict. And once again, we have users' data. We understand users' behavior, but actually all of them is to provide a better user experience. So for us, data is to improve our customer journey. It's not for us to data to sell the data to any third party and monetize them. That's not our intention at all. And I think that's a key differentiation. People are comfortable using Dana because they know they get protected, not only on their transactions. We have the best risk management probably in the whole region, or one of the best in the whole world. And we also protect customer data privacy. We protect it so much that we even don't allow anyone on Dana itself to have access to any sort of the data of our users or even our own data in the company. Even the developers have no access to any sort of public data that people trust to us.
Understood. I was thinking, if you have someone who is buying large ticket items and you feel is very likely a high quality user of our services, I could envision extending to them some very interesting credit-based products in the future or diversifying the services we can offer them. Do you give thought to that?
Okay. That's in terms of targeting, personalizations, and those are the kind of things definitely something that we do within our platform, but it's more options, right? And the offering. So users have choice whether they want it or not. So once again, I think the most important is the data is being used to improve the user experience. It's also always been the key. We don't want to force, we don't want to intrude, we don't want to automatically accept on behalf of the users. That's never been the way we operate. We always give back the choice to the users, but in a way that is so convenient, so then the users have the ability to choose whether they accept it or not in non-intrusive way and in the things that they feel would be important or relevant to them.
Crystal clear. Now, you recently mentioned that Dana now has roughly 120 million users and is processing 10 million transactions per day. What would our targets be, for instance, year-end 2023?
Oh, gosh. We will definitely let you know. As I mentioned, we never really want to talk too much about ourselves, only when we can already back that numbers up. But just to give you an indication of how we've grown in the last 1.5 years. So this year, in terms of our overall TPV or GTV, gross transaction values, compared to last year, in 6 months of this year, we're already overtaken the whole year of last year. So that's the rate of growth that we're seeing. And that's not only just in terms of GTV is the top line, but you talk about the transaction numbers, you talk about the new users, we've grown significantly. Some of them are growing about 100%, some of them are growing about 50%. So overall, we've seen tremendous growth. And we really believe that's indications of this market adoptions and the affinity of people. And because the acceptance is getting wider and wider, right? Last year, when we talk about offline acceptance, there's like 14.5 million, right? If I'm not mistaken, at the end of the year. And now it's already at 20 million. And we hope at the end of the year, it's going to grow even more. So now it's really, as I mentioned to you, it's about the adoptions of the people using it. I've literally no cash now in my wallet. And I do everywhere, even payment, not only just at any kind of mid or upscale restaurant, but even for the street vendors, even paying for parking attendant, I've used Dana.
Fantastic. What a robust growth trajectory we're on. Now, I wanted to ask you, Vince, what do you view as the most exciting ancillary financial services surrounding the payments vertical currently?
That's a very interesting question. We've been looking at the market consistently because we were worried, are we late in getting into the market? Because the market has been very robust, as you mentioned, so there's a lot of players. But if you take a look in the total adoptions, and then these three categories, lending, investment, and insurance, the penetration is still very, very small. It's very early. I mean, if you take a look into the lending, it's less than 10% of the addressable population, so accepting lending, like overall, even less in insurance, unless you consider BBGS, which is our social security and insurance. If that's the numbers you're benchmarking, that it's pretty high. It's at 86 million. And investment is also even lower. So overall, the market is still very underserved. So we're so excited about this opportunity because we want people to get into these financial services, not just because we consider that as part of our monetization strategy, but really to give this financial inclusion, really healthy financial inclusion. And part of our missions that we always put in our mission statement is we want to bridge Indonesian society, not only to give them access to financial inclusion, but also education. Because the number one biggest problem is overall, the general population still have very little understanding of how overall this financial inclusion works. For example, we talk about insurance, protecting against future incidents. I think a lot of people still vague of how that works. You talk about lending, it's making sure that you receive money in advance so that it can help you to do your, for example, your business, your daily activities. But then you have to have awareness of paying on time, fees associated with paying late, with the compounding interest, all those sort of things. We are very conscious to make sure that we will not only just give them access, because give them access is like we mentioned earlier, give them access. Most of the people are accessible now because of the smartphone, because of the payment rail, because of so many players in the market. So giving them access is no longer the issue. Now, educating them to make sure they don't get trapped into this bad behavior, it's very crucial. And that's always been our passion to make sure that people can get into this financial inclusion in a healthy, in a very sustainable kind of way.
What a fantastic panorama you presented of Indonesia's clearly ever-changing payments landscape. Still very early days and a lot of exciting growth ahead. Thanks for joining us today, Vince.
Thank you, Alan.
We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's episode. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indo Techno podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.